Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo Is There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and this is a Seth's Pick episode, this time about Snow Crash, the Neal Stephenson 1992 novel that wasn't actually nominated for a bunch of awards, but is kind of considered a cyberpunk classic by a lot of people. And so that's why I put it on my list of books that I would like to cover at some point. And Leah Borden reached out to me and said she'd love to cover it. So hi, Leah. Thanks for joining me.
Hi, Seth.
Now, you know, with this kind of episode, sometimes I tap somebody and say, hey, will you cover this book with me? And so the why this book kind of question doesn't really come into things. But in this case, you reached out and wanted to cover it because you saw it on the list. So can you tell me a little bit about yourself, and then we can kind of move in to talk about why this book?
Well, I live in St. Louis with my family, and I'm an aspiring data scientist. I've got a master's degree in computer science. This was way after the time of this book, and I've been a Hugo voter since 2015 when John Scalzi said it's extremely important that you vote. But this book came into my life, but before that, mostly when it came out, the literary fiction world, you know, was excited about it. And I love this book because, you know, it had such an open appeal to myth more than any notions that it had about the internet, because I think, you know, why people thought the metaverse was cool at the time was it was an opportunity for self-creation. And you see that, you know, more or less with people, you know, who've made their lives in the metaverse over the course of the book. But I mean, 30 years later, it's an entirely different book, which I guess, you know, we'll talk about some more.
Yeah, definitely. And because when did you first read this book?
1992-ish.
You did? Okay. So right after it came out.
Right after it came out, yeah.
Okay, perfect. And, you know, for me, this is a first-time read for me. I haven't read a lot of Stephenson. I think I read The Diamond Age for this podcast, and then I've also read The Rise and Fall of Dodo, but that was a co-write, so I don't know, you know, how much of it was actually Stephenson writing it and how much it was his co-author.
Yeah, I read Cryptonomicon, and I read The Baroque Cycle, and I read Anathema and Seven Eves.
Okay.
But I haven't done anything, you know, of anything he's written after that.
Okay. That's still a lot more exposure to Stephenson and his writing than I have.
Yes. But, I mean, you know, once he gets to the Diamond Age, you know, he knows much more, you know, what kind of writer he wants to be. And I think the award voters figured this out because I realized, you know, because of this, that I'd never actually read Neuromancer. And and if that is what you think cyberpunk is, then a lot of the things in Snow Crash are going to seem cartoonish, especially, you know, the violence is going to be much more cartoonish than what's in Neuromancer near the end. Yeah.
So I think this is one of the kind of books that it's really hard to have any kind of non-spoiler discussion. And so,
yes.
You know, everybody consider yourself warned. We're going to talk about kind of everything, but I do think it's one of those books too, that just because we're spoiling it doesn't necessarily spoil it, because it's more about the way the characters interact. It's more about kind of Neal Stephenson's very particular style. So, you know, don't be afraid to listen and then decide to go read the book later.
Okay.
So let's just talk about sort of overall thoughts about this one. And we've already gotten a little bit of yours. I'll say, I'm not sure how much I vibe with Stephenson. What I find is his work definitely rewards a reread because sometimes he throws so much crap at you that it's hard to keep track of the parts that are important. And I definitely felt that in The Diamond Age, where it starts off with this whole scene about this guy getting a skull gun. And I was like, what, what are we even doing here? And he's a very minor character. And it kind of, Snow Crash started the same way with me where, you know, hero protagonist, the Deliverator, which cracked me up, is delivering pizzas. And I was having a hard time figuring out, what am I supposed to connect to here? And so I worked my way through it, kind of reading between I have the ebook and I have the audiobook, and kind of shifting back and forth between them. And if you had asked me 2 weeks ago, what'd you think of the book, I would have gone, I don't know. You know, it was fine, I suppose. But mm-hmm. then you and I kind of went back and forth on trying to schedule this. And I realized, oh, I've got some extra time. So I went back and listened to the whole audiobook again and really enjoyed it on the second time.
Okay.
So so it is kind of a two-time read for me, but it's two times in a month. So for you, let's kind of get back to that later. I think we should kind of dive into what the book is about.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just to see if we can entice people to pick it up. Do you want to tackle that? Do you want me to?
Yeah, I'll tackle that. Sure.
Okay, go for it.
Okay. Almost the first. The first thing that we see, you know, is hero protagonist is a deliverator. He delivers pizzas, and he's a hacker. He's delivering pizzas in a world where the U.S. government is just, you know, one enclave claiming power in the what used to be the Los Angeles metropolitan area. And you have the mafia with their own enclave. You have burb claves. You have Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong, which is a mafia enclave of its own. Mm-hmm. And you have the metaverse, which at least used to be a place where hackers hung out. But it's grown, you know, that now that there's something called the street, which goes around about halfway around the space that's allocated to it. And it's a commercial zone with all kinds of with every kind of virtual reality stimulus you can name. And someone is trying to has knocked out hero protagonist's friend and former employer, Day 5 admirer, 5 instead of a V. Mm-hmm. Has used a virtual reality avatar to walk up to him and show him a scroll and put him into a state of unconsciousness. And Hero has to find out, how to save save all the rest of the hackers from becoming victim to this. And there's a murder relatively early of someone who's already figured this out. And is able to give information to a librarian in the metaverse, who would be an AI assistant nowadays, so that Hero can more or less go back to ancient Sumer to figure out what has gone on. And the villain once again cartoonish is a very wealthy evangelical from Texas, where L. Bob Reif Bible College has been doing all the excavations in Sumer. In order to find the document that will put all the hackers in his thrall with the Namship of Enki. Mm-hmm. And he's using the raft, which is a completely anarchic conglomeration of refugees from the Third World, in order to distract whoever's in power, so that he can do this. And so the second half of the book is, you know, essentially a very wild pursuit in order to take the Namship of Enki from L. Bob Reif, the villain.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, that's pretty good. Without getting into too much of the nitty-gritty details, I think that's a good kind of presentation of it. And the setting of it, as you kind of hinted with the metaverse, it's certainly cyberpunk, right? Where you have the reality of the United States that's not really a thing anymore. The federal government exists, but it's just one of many kind of semi-autonomous states. You mentioned Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong, which is not part of Hong Kong at all.
Right.
Narcolumbia, which I felt like, is that offensive? And then all the burb claves as well. And, you know, each of these places might have a mercenary troop who's their security, right? There's places that are guarded by these dog hybrid things called rat things.
Right.
Just because you have access to one burb clave doesn't mean that you're going to be welcome in another place.
Right.
And so at the very beginning, you have Hero, he pulls up, he's working for Cosa Nostra Pizza, and he pulls up and there's a fire at the pizzeria, which leaves him with 12 minutes to deliver this pizza. And he's got it all planned out. He knows exactly how to do it. He knows the exact route he needs to do. And then he tries to drive through this burb clave and realizes, oh, things have changed. And he crashes and mm-hmm. he gets lucky that a courier named YT, who's also
I left her out, but yeah. I didn't know how to put her in without a lot of spoilers.
Yeah, I think it's hard to nail down, even though his name is hero protagonist. It's sort of a dueling protagonist thing.
Yeah,
a lot of the plot moves forward because of YT.
Yeah,
where hero is over on the side just listening to the librarian.
Yeah.
And she's a fascinating character. I really loved YT. And YT stands for yours truly, but everybody always accidentally pronounces it Whitey. And she skates around and harpoons vehicles with this magnetic harpoon they just call a poon. And the skateboard that she has, you know, I used to skateboard as a kid. And if you hit the tiniest little rock, you are on your face. But her skateboard has these special wheels that can basically go over any terrain at all. And that's such a cool technology. Not quite a hoverboard, but effectively does the work of what a hoverboard might do. Mm-hmm. She is 15 years old, and well, that's just not going to be problematic at all.
No, of course not.
But YT she comes in and she's harpooned Hero, and so when he's about to fail his delivery, she says, "I can deliver it for you." So mm-hmm. she delivers it, which draws the favorable eye of Uncle Enzo, who's a mob boss, who turns out to be a really good dude, which is kind of fascinating. And that's one thing I will say in the book, the characters are pretty well drawn, and you like, there's several really likable characters, or, you know, the ones that you're not supposed to like, they're kind of loathsome.
Yes.
You also hinted at the snow crash of the title, right? It has to do with this virus that somebody gives David in the metaverse, and it crashes his terminal, but it also seems to crash his brain. It's like it overwrote his master boot record on his brain.
I think more than what's been written over in the root sector in his brain, you know, is his ability to be a hacker has been written over.
Yes.
Because the goal is to undo the Tower of Babel, to have one word correspond to one real thing, one concept in the world. And what a hacker does is to find something new in the abstract structure of a programming language or of a program that no one ever saw before. Mm. That was the thing about Neuromancer, that, you know, the Chinese program was suddenly doing all the work for them. Mm-hmm. And I mean, were they really hackers anymore?
Right.
Right. I mean, were they just coming along for the ride?
Yeah. And that's the kind of the two sides of the snow crash, right? Where there's snow crashes specifically targeted at the hackers, right? To hurt them, because they have the ability to kind of understand, I guess, binary code. And so they're shown this bitmap and that crashes them.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But the other side of it is L. Bob Reif has kind of discovered that this, you know, ancient Sumerian language gives him control over people, mm-hmm. where he's able to affect them with this neurolinguistic virus. And mm-hmm. that was all really, really interesting. And the whole, like you said, reversing Babel event, where Hero literally just talks to the Expositron 2000, otherwise known as the Librarian, talking about glossolalia and xenoglossia and the gift of tongues and the day of Pentecost in the Bible. And it's really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, you know, Neal Stephenson says, I mean, essentially Neal Stephenson said, you know, any errors are essentially my responsibility, but I don't think, you know, the scholar, I think, you know, he absorbed in the Library of Congress about as much as anyone knows even today about this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's definitely tie-ins with contemporary culture. I mean, you have a lot of at least pseudo-Christian groups who are sponsoring archaeological digs. And there was just something in the news the other day about they've discovered new structures under the pyramids in Egypt, which is fascinating. I don't think that was a Christian group doing that. But you have a lot of groups of, you know, Christian and Jewish and others in the Holy Land, you know, mm-hmm. Doing archaeological work. And all the exposition, I wanted to be bored with it, and I couldn't be, because it was really fascinating. I think there was something that stuck out to you about when the librarian was kind of giving a breakdown of the different sects of Judaism in the first century.
Yeah. This is the email that I sent you. Yeah. I got sufficient religion since the second time I read this book that this absolutely grated on me. Mm-hmm. It makes sense entirely for who the characters are. That, you know, Juanita says, who's the love interest in this book, that, you know, Judaism was an attempt at rational religion at the time of the Deuteronomist, but then it devolved into empty legalism. And, what's happening is not empty, and it's centered on the temple and the priests. But what I think the state of scholarship is about this is that the Sadducees and the Pharisees collaborated in running the temple. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Pharisees are not exactly the rabbinic Judaism, but rabbinic Judaism claims descent from them. And the descriptions, of the temple and what went on there is, you know, the Pharisaical interpretation of it, but, it's probably as close as, there is some conflict between the Sadducees and the Pharisees about, you know, what the high priest does in Yom Kippur. And, you know, the account that comes down to is the Pharisees end up winning. Mm-hmm. But the reason that the Pharisees end up winning is that, you know, this temple and the priests are really all the Sadducees had. I mean, the Pharisees had the ability to hack that the Sadducees did not. And that's why you have any kind of viable Judaism nowadays.
Right. And that survived the destruction of the temple.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think, you know, it's fair to say that that some of the stuff that the librarian says is oversimplified, right?
Right. Yes.
It's not a scholarly paper. Not really.
No, it's not a scholar paper, but yeah. I mean, but I don't think the librarian said it. I think, you know, it's Juanita and Hero interpreting what the librarian said. And I mean, clearly, you know, Hero wants to agree with Juanita as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, and Juanita is kind of a not post-Christian. I think she calls herself a Christian, but
she's a Catholic.
But has moved into a new kind of Christianity that rejects the resurrection, right? Which is kind of a central tenet of Christianity.
Yes.
Pretty important. if there's one character that I feel is not as developed as the others, it is Juanita to me.
Mm-hmm, yeah. And, that's part of the change in the book, you know, that Juanita was responsible for the faces in the metaverse and was able, at least in the one club where they're all meeting, and that she was able not to throw brute force at it, and you know, and you thought, you know, that Neal Stephenson was really going to go a great deal to relate this idea to everything else in the book, but it seems to have fallen flat the second time around.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So Elbob, right? You kind of also kind of the way you have dual protagonists, you almost have dual antagonists.
Yes.
Because you have Elbob Reif, who's the man kind of who thinks he's running everything. And then you have Raven, who kind of works for him, but not really.
Raven has his own motivation altogether.
Yeah. And he's like this ultimate Aleut badass who kills people with these glass weapons, which I'm not sure how they're durable enough to work for some of those things, but we'll leave that aside. But there's really interesting kind of it's kind of convenient that Hero and Raven have this connected history of their fathers from World War II.
Yes. And clearly, you know, Cryptonomicon is the World War II saga, you know, that lets Stevenson develop this a lot more. That's got nothing to do with the Aleutian Islands, though. It's centered, you know, on the American code breakers.
Yeah.
And Enoch Root, who is evidently, you know, who's evidently lived an extremely long time at the center, transfers to the Baroque cycle, or at least someone who has the same name.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Okay. So Elbob Reif, at some point, he's kind of giving a, I can't remember if it was Elbob Reif or it was whoever the pastor was who was kind of under him, where it's almost like, are you familiar with the show Severance?
Yes, yes, it's a great show. I have not seen any of the second season, but it is a great show.
Okay, it continues to be a great show in the second season. But he almost wants severance because he talks about his programmers. He's complaining about the programmers get to take their knowledge home with them, and he wants to control that. And that's one of the reasons that he's doing the things he's doing. Mm-hmm. So Whitey really does kind of drive the plot because she ends up on the raft and connected with Raven. And this is where some of the problematic stuff comes in. If you want to have a character who's going to be an object of sexual desire in your book, you can just make her 18. You don't have to make her 15.
Yes.
And so some of that stuff is really, really weird. So, I mean, I know that ages of consent are basically arbitrary, but we have one that we're comfortable with in the United States.
Yes, yes. And unfortunately, I think that's an artifact of its time. I mean,
I will say one of the things every now and then when kind of thinking about making notes for a book, you know, I Google some things, words that I was unfamiliar with. And with this one, if you want to go down an unpleasant clickhole, Google dentata because
yeah
that was interesting.
Yes, and that is absolutely problematic. You know that's an extremely important plot point.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
Very much. But you know she I would never say that she becomes a damsel in distress at all.
No. And I mean you know you have Raven giving her the thumbs up because she saved herself, you know, and with a lot of sheer nerve in order to do it. And yes.
Well, and one of the things that I really like is that a key decision that she makes to be kind to one of the rat things.
Yes, yes.
And to at some risk, right? Because you know it's basically a wild animal, but sort of a programmed wild animal. And she saves its life, right? Gets it back to its home so that it can survive. And it always thinks of her as the nice lady. His name is Fido, and he's a very good boy.
Very good boy.
And so he comes in at the end and is the one to actually take down El Bob Reif, which is pretty interesting.
Yeah. And you know that could relate, you know, to Juanita and the Faces, you know, that this was, you know, a random act of kindness by someone who loved dogs. Mm-hmm. And that survived, you know, all the robotic brute force that was done to that dog's brain.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, just sort of, you know, you have the imprint of Whitey's face, on the rat thing. Probably she might not recognize him ever.
Yeah.
Even. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, basically the interesting thing about the kind of what I've said about YT driving the plot is that Hero kind of ends up getting orders from Uncle Enzo to go in and help extract YT. And Uncle Enzo goes in with him as well. And that's one of the...
Right. But I mean, Juanita's on that boat too. So, I mean, he's got every reason to do it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, he has more than one reason to go in. And, I will say one of the things that in the first read, I've had a hard time with this in the past with some cyberpunk is remembering when characters are in the virtual world and when they're in the real world. And so the whole confrontation between Hero and Raven on my first reading, I thought it was in the real world, but it's really in the virtual world. And then in the real world, Raven is confronted by Uncle Enzo.
Mm-hmm. And so, yes. Yes. I mean, that was not hard to tell apart because, I mean, you know, Hero's, Hero's job there is to prevent, you know, Raven from showing the scroll to the hackers at the benefit for David with a five. And so you have these virtual reality presentations that would never happen in the real world.
Mm-hmm. It just got mixed up in my brain.
Mixed up in your brain. It's okay. Yeah. It's okay.
And the, you know, Stevenson kind of goes a fair distance to sort of do a little world building about how the metaverse works, because it talks about how, you know, he has Hiro get confronted by somebody who wants to test his mettle against supposedly the greatest swordsman in the metaverse.
And so you
have that very bloodless fight that ends up with the guy's arms cut off and his head cut off, and then the metaverse kind of cleans itself up, but it takes some time, and so that person is kicked out of the metaverse as long as his corpse is still there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, and that
matters extremely because Hiro knows enough about the plumbing that he can stop Raven from coming back.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Because I think Hiro programmed the janitorial, the cleanup crew.
That's right. Yes. 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 Yeah.
Some of there's a lot of slang in the book, right? Where you kind of have to, infer that a bimbo box is, I guess, a minivan.
I guess so too. this is not the kind of book where you have a 10-page glossary at the end.
No, it's not.
No,
and the refugees, which are, you know, they're part of the kind of the flotilla with the raft. They're referred to as refuse, and so you know, when you say it out loud, you're like, were you trying to make us say refuse, like trash?
But there's, you know, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and yeah. certainly this way, these days in the United States, with the attitude towards a significant portion of our population towards, asylum seekers and other migrants, that I feel like there are people who would latch onto that kind of terminology.
Right. Right. And that's how the book has changed. You know, I mean, you have, you know, people in power who have no idea that there's any such thing as an asylum claim, who would wish, you know, that would go away.
Right.
And you know, the idea that, you know, that someone is that, you know, the United States is being invaded by a gang, you know, people who have learned, you know, serious gang behavior. I mean, that's a very precise parallel. But obviously, you know, when Rife chooses to give them an order, they're going to obey him.
Yes, because he's kind of hacked their brains, right?
Yes, he has hacked all of their brains. Yes.
And, you know, in terms of a megalomaniac kind of ideas of having control over everything, you know, it's the whole plot that he has is pretty smart, you know, that he realized we need to control this Namjug of Enki, right? Keep it in its clay envelope. Or whatever it is, because that's the vulnerability that we have. Now, mm-hmm. I don't know why they wouldn't maybe destroy it. I guess it was under lock and key, you know, it was yes, hidden away. Yes. But you know, that gives Hiro a MacGuffin to go after.
Right.
Because once he has that, then he can have the librarian read out the Sumerian, and that's essentially the antivirus.
Right, exactly.
Vaccine. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, if there's any such thing as, I mean, you could probably ship it back, almost, you know, ship it back to Babylonia.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the Iraqi National Museum is functioning as the Iraqi National Museum in this world, which there may not be, but
yeah. I mean, that gets into a whole discussion of museums and where the provenance of the items that they have, like, you know, lots of stuff at the British Museum in particular.
Exactly. Know. Yes. Yes.
Should we still have this here in Britain?
Yes.
So, yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I was following the story of the Ben and Bronzes a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's some fun that Neil Stephen has with language, where at some point when Hiro is on his journey to the raft, you know, he has to get there over the ocean, you know, on the sea, and he falls in with this group of people who I think are pirates of some kind.
One of them
comments to the people that they're trying to essentially board, you know, or deal with, they'll listen to reason. And then it turns out that reason is the name of his super deadly depleted uranium uber machine gun.
Cartoon violence, what can I say?
Very much, yeah. and you know, the book does have a lot of sort of fun action sequences, where like the geography of everything is actually pretty well laid out, where you kind of know what's actually going on, which I appreciate.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, that's the thing, you know, that is at least a recognizable thing in our world. You know, you can get it right, you know, very easily, just as, you know, you would you could extrapolate from the internet of that time for the metaverse and, you know, have people recognize that, that this could actually happen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, clearly, you know, the Pacific Coast, you know, that's your part of the world, and you know whether he got, you know, whether he was accurate about the travel times or anything that he sees, I would not know.
Yeah, I mean, everybody travels a little faster than I think we're actually able to.
okay.
But yeah, I'm from Alaska originally, and so even some of the stuff about there was one point where it talked about Raven Cook Inlet in Alaska and then drifting out to Kodiak, and I thought, I don't think that's possible.
Okay. All right. So I didn't know that.
Yeah. The Cook Inlet is basically right. It comes all the way up to Anchorage, basically.
Okay.
And yeah, you don't, I'm sure you can get to Kodiak if you have the right vessel, but just to drift out to it, I think that would take weeks, but,
okay. But
I don't know. And also the, you know, the Cook Inlet, there's some, the tides are quite extreme where there's just mud flats out there when the tides are out. And not that I'm recommending people walk on them because people actually die doing that because they get stuck and then the tide comes back in and it's a real hazard. So in the audiobook, at some point one of the characters is talking about some Alaskan berg clave or something called, you know, Kenai Kodiak.
Yeah. Yeah. You're right. Right.
He pronounced it Kenai and I thought, okay, this is, nobody asks somebody from Alaska about that.
Right.
Because it is Kenai.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a really interesting book. And you know, you'd mentioned that, you know, one of the factors of on your reread with it hitting differently was just, you know, politics have changed. I think you said that from your, in terms of your religious background has changed as well. Or not background, maybe, but expression.
Right. Yeah.
But did you enjoy it as much or
I guess that I was sad, you know, that this had sort of been reduced to the level of prose. I mean, especially, you know, since you know, I've been exposed to writers, you know, who have a much more, you know, directly literary prose style. I mean, I think William Gibson is one of those people, and Susanna Clarke is one of those people.
Yeah.
Probably Ursula Vernon / T. Kingfisher is.
Hmm.
And you know, for all these people, you know, even in Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, the myth is not an info dump. You know, you're walking around inside the myth, and they all have sufficient genius, you know, in describing setting that you can do that. Where almost, you know, the setting is its own character, and it interacts, you know, with their characters in its own right.
I think, you know, I've kind of run towards the end of my notes, and we've talked kind of randomly about lots of the different stuff that happens in the book. But maybe we should move into sort of final thoughts.
Do I have any final thoughts? I think this is still worth reading, you know, 30 years later, and not just, you know, to know what the metaverse was when someone first imagined it.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to be terrifically entertained by it. It's going to be, you know, idea centric the way the best SF is idea centric. You're going to have very well drawn individual characters in this. For a book that's, you know, maybe 400 pages long, it's going to move like YT's skateboard. You're probably going to think about, you know, the kind of world building, you know, that each of us does, you know, as an individual person, trying to make sense of things. How tempting, you know, it is to be controlled by someone who offers transcendence, how it does not have to be that way. No one who is at all a sympathetic character lets it be that way in this book.
Agreed. Yeah.
Agreed.
Yeah. I mean, I'd echo a lot about of what you said is that, you know, there's really exciting portions of this book. There's really interesting concepts that are brought up, and the characters are fun. I think if hero protagonist isn't the most amazing main character, YT is there to kind of fill the gap. And
right. Exactly. And, yeah. It's a very balanced split between who the main character is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Good stuff.
Okay.
I'm a little surprised that it wasn't a more honored book, given its reputation as the years have gone by. Because it
But I mean, you know, as I said, I mean, William Gibson's cast such a shadow over the whole field to the people who vote on this, and Bruce Sterling, probably, you know, people who take the subject matter much more seriously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was nominated for the Clark Award and the British Science Fiction Award.
Right, right. And nothing else.
Yeah.
And I mean, as I think I emailed you, I mean, you know, it was up against Vorkosigan in both of the years that it could have been nominated. Mm. So it was never going to win a Hugo. But that it was not nominated, I was stunned by that.
Yeah, that was surprising. But, you know, it's one of those ones that, because of its reputation, that's kind of why it found its way onto my list, just because people had said, well, you should read Snow Crash. So,
right. Oh, okay. I didn't know. I thought you had experience with this book before.
No, it was brand new to me. And it was one of the ones that I think, one of the inciting incidents for starting this podcast was I came across one of those BuzzFeed lists, you know, how many of these famous science fiction books have you read? And I remember thinking, I thought I would have read more of those, but, you know, now I've read a lot more of them. I actually wrote them on the list.
Yes, yes.
And Snow Crash was certainly one of them. So,
mm-hmm. Okay.
So yeah, it was kind of an easy one to put on my Seth's Picks list. And so I want to thank you, Leah, for picking it and for coming on the podcast to talk about it.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, José Saramago is clearly a better Seth's pick than this book. I mean, even without having read it yet. But sure. I mean, you know, Ursula Le Guin's going to give it a good review. No more need to be said here.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. But this was definitely worth covering. And I'm glad that I've read it. And I was glad that kind of in our scheduling difficulty, I had some extra time so that I could review just let it sink in a little more. And maybe that's just a thing with Stevenson and me. I need to give it more than one shot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. Well, Leah, thank you again so much for doing this. And
sure, no problem.
It was great talking to you. Bye now. Well, folks, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Leah. It's a really interesting book, and it was fun to get to cover that. It's also a book that's kind of random, and so I feel like the conversation was a little bit random, but that's I think, the way a discussion of Snow Crash is going to go, unless you want to be really regimented about things, and I never want that. I do want to let everybody know that I'm going to be in Seattle for Worldcon. I will be attending. So I would love to meet with people there. By this time, you will have seen that this podcast was shortlisted again for the Hugo Award for Best Fancast. So thank you so much for everybody who nominated the podcast. And so I appreciate your votes if you're a voter as well. If last year is any, or if last Worldcon was any indication, I will probably be offered a space to do a live podcast recording. I'd kind of like to do something, just not totally sure what I want to do. So if you're somebody who would be interested in doing something like that and participating, send me your ideas and I will consider them, because yeah, I don't have that many ideas of my own. But mostly, I just want to meet up with people that I've met through the podcast. And if you're out there and you have never sent me any pings or anything, let me know you're going to be at Worldcon and we can meet up. Unless, of course, the point was you didn't send me any pings because you want to keep the parasocial relationship exactly as it is. And that's fine, too. Of course, you can sign up to support the podcast if you'd like to on Patreon or on Buy Me a Coffee. You can share episodes with your social media. Follow me on the various platforms. And we can interact that way. Or not. All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye.
The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Kusky.